Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Today is Monday, December 23rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A crush of people scrambling for free food in Nigeria leads to more deaths.
Another tragedy struck at the Holy Trinity Catholic Church, Maitama in Abuja, in a similar stampede occurred during the distribution of food items to vulnerable and elderly individuals.
The RSF takes back control of a key Sudanese base, and an analyst says Sudanese will suffer even more next year if the new U.S. administration does not act soon.
I think that Sudan, because it's not a kind of first-order national security priority, it could suffer from a lack of attention. And I think the consequences in the coming months from a lack of attention could be catastrophic for the people of Sudan.
And the UN Security Council extends its peacekeeping mandate in the DR Congo. Sudan's paramilitary rapid support forces say they took back control of a key logistical base in North Darfur on Sunday, one day after it was taken by rival forces allied with Sudan's army. The conflict between the RSF and the army broke out some 20 months ago. Some of the fiercest fighting has occurred in North Darfur as the army and its allied joint forces, a contingent of former rebel groups, have been battling to maintain a last foothold in the wider Darfur region. The joint forces and the army said in statements they had taken control on Saturday of the Al-Zurig base, which the RSF has used during the 20 months of war, as a base to channel supplies from over the nearby borders with Chad and Libya. They said dozens of RSF soldiers were killed, their vehicles destroyed, and supplies taken back as the joint forces captured the base. The RSF has accused joint forces fighters of killing civilians and burning down nearby homes. The joint forces says the RSF base had been used as a launching point for what it calls barbaric operations against civilians in places like Al-Fashir, the capital of North Darfur State. Cameron Hudson, senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies Africa program, tells me that U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who led two meetings late last week with the U.N. Security Council on Sudan, was focused on that African country for good reason.
I think they're thinking about their legacy, and they were handed off a Sudan that was a kind of hopeful country in democratic transition, and they're turning over a country that's in smoldering ruins after 20 months of civil war, the largest displacement crisis, the largest humanitarian crisis in the world. So I think what we're seeing right now is an attempt by the Biden administration to put Sudan maybe on a more stable path, hoping that some of the momentum that they breathe into the process right now gets picked up and carried forward in a new Trump administration.
Why didn't Blinken at this time, you talk about legacy, why didn't he focus on Russia's invasion of Ukraine and Ukraine trying to defend itself? U.S. has been a strong supporter of Ukraine through all of this and the Middle East. Why not focus on that as well?
Well, I think that he recognizes that Sudan could be something of an orphan case, that the Trump administration and those coming in have already articulated a set of plans and priorities with respect to the Middle East, with respect to the war in Ukraine. So those are not conflicts that are going to suffer from a lack of attention from the incoming administration. But I think that Sudan, because it's not a kind of first order national security priority, it could suffer from a lack of attention. And I think the consequences in the coming months from a lack of attention could be catastrophic for the people of Sudan, given the dire humanitarian situation. So again, I think he's trying to build some space for humanitarians to have access to the country over the next several months, hoping that that creates the time and the space for a new political process to somehow take hold in ending the war there.
There's been a call by several humanitarian groups for an international presence in Sudan on the ground before any kind of ceasefire is finally reached, if ever one is, because there, as you know, talks have been on again, off again. Sometimes one side meets, the other side doesn't even show up. How likely is that to happen?
I think it's pretty unlikely at this point, certainly given what we know about the incoming Trump administration's views on UN peacekeeping. You know, in the last Trump administration, they were trying to cut peacekeeping budgets and limit U.S. support for peacekeeping. I think we have to expect that to continue. Certainly, I think it would be hard to imagine creating new peacekeeping operations. I think the UN and others are just trying to keep their head above water and maintain the peacekeeping operations where they are already deployed, places like Eastern Congo or even Haiti. So the idea of standing up a new peacekeeping operation when African governments themselves have yet to kind of raise their hand and commit troops to that kind of exercise feels very unlikely given the incoming administration.
You were in East Africa not that long ago, and you got to meet with some officials in that region. What was your takeaway with the situation in Sudan, the political aspects of any kind of possibility of a ceasefire and things getting better in 2025?
Well, I was actually surprised talking to Sudanese army officials, the kind of consensus that there needs to be an end to the war and that there likely isn't going to be a kind of battlefield victory that is definitive in a way that would prevent the RSF from posing a threat into the future. So they recognize, I think, that there needs to be an international process guaranteed by the international community, enforced by the international community, for there to be lasting peace in the country. Given that recognition, you know, you're hearing both sides essentially say that they're not ready to stop fighting. But I think that there's room for a deal to be made here. I think that 20 months of fighting and destruction has created a lot of fatigue, not just among the warring parties themselves, but among the neighboring states. Many countries like the United Arab Emirates have taken a real black eye in the international media for their support for this war. I think other neighboring states like Chad and Central African Republic recognize that while they are profiting from the war, that it's destructive for the region. And I think everybody recognizes that countries like Iran and Russia are probably the big winners in all of this, profiting the most, having their diplomatic credentials burnished in the region. And that's probably not good for the countries in the region. So I think as this has dragged on, I think more and more we see that there has to be some way out that's not military, that is a negotiated settlement. Putting all these pieces together is going to be the tricky diplomacy that's required.
Many analysts and lawmakers have said that one of the keys to getting this resolved is getting the UAE out of the picture and stop propping up one side. And they're accused of propping up the RSF, although they deny it. Is there any movement on that ground that you saw while you were there?
Well, no, not really. I think that the UAE, because they continue to deny any level of support to the RSF, doesn't open up the possibility for a constructive conversation about what would be necessary, what they require to see in Sudan, to give them the assurances that they need, that their interests would be protected. They're clearly under the impression that only the rapid support forces are going to protect their long-term interests in Sudan. I think they have to be disabused of that notion that whatever their interests are, whether they're financial or political or strategic, that some successor regime other than the RSF will be able to take their interests into account in governing the country. But I think until they feel that, they're not going to relent in their support to the RSF. It'll be interesting to see if the Trump administration has any new leverage over the UAE that the Biden administration wasn't able to muster themselves. I think these are big questions right now.
That's Sudan analyst Cameron Hudson speaking with me earlier in Washington. Police authorities in Nigeria say at least 13 people died in two new incidents in the country on Saturday as crowds, mostly women and children, scrambled for free food and other charity. In the state capital, Abuja, at least 10 people died and dozens more were injured in a scramble to receive gifts being distributed by the Holy Trinity Catholic Church in Maitama District. Engineer Nawankolo Nandi says when they opened the gate, security officials told people to calm down, but they refused to listen.
Well, they don't open gate once. Even though the security lie down, say, I beg, calm down, no way. Before you know it, so people, they cry, here I'm there, people, they cry, people jumping on top of fence. People jumping.
That is Nigerian engineer Nwankwo Nnamdi speaking to Reuters news agency. Nigerian Police Public Relations Officer Muyiwa Adejobi calls it another tragedy just days after a stampede occurred at an Islamic high school holiday fair in Nigeria's southwestern Oyo State, which killed over 30 people.
In the early hours of today, the 21st of December 2024, another tragedy struck at the Holy Trinity Catholic Church, Maitama in Abuja, in a similar stampede occurred during the distribution of food items to vulnerable and elderly individuals. This unfortunate incident led to the death of 10 individuals, leaving many others injured.
That was Nigerian Police Public Relations Officer Muyiwa Adejobi speaking to Reuters. In Okija in Anambra State, southeastern Nigeria, a crowd crush happened after a member of the community offered gifts, including rice, vegetable oil, and money. State police said three people were confirmed dead there, although eyewitnesses and Amnesty International Nigeria put the death toll at 20, with several more injured. In both incidents, the victims were primarily women and children who were trampled to death. Some Nigerian analysts have raised concerns about a report which said Nigerians paid more than $1 billion in ransom to kidnappers this past year. Mike Mbonye reports from Lagos.
Dr. Mohamed Sani Abubakar is a senior lecturer in the Department of Military Studies at the University of Abuja. He says the National Bureau of Statistics report on insecurity in Nigeria in 1 year is very concerning. The Bureau said that between May 2023 to April 2024, Nigerians paid 2.3 trillion naira or $1.41 billion to kidnappers in the country. The report also said 614,937 Nigerians were killed, while 2.2 million were kidnapped across the country in the same period. Sani said the report did not come as a surprise and that government should act decisively.
Because if bandits or terrorists can receive money to the tune of 2.3 trillion within just 12 months, how much is the police force receiving from the government? You know, how much are they getting from the budget? How much is the military as an institution getting to execute, to achieve their objective? So now you have non-state actors receiving this kind of money from Nigerians. It's a pathetic situation. And I think it is high time we declare a state of emergency on this issue of kidnap for ransom.
A breakdown of the data showed that rural areas recorded more murders, 335,827, than urban areas, which reported 279,110. Sani says one way of tackling crime in the country is for all stakeholders to act.
I believe these are all clarion calls for the army, the military to sit up. Not just the military, the police and the politicians equally to sit up. Because some of these things, you begin to go and ask, what are the root causes?
Matthew Chukwuma, a Lagos-based legal practitioner and public affairs analyst, says the government should send more security personnel to rural areas to protect people.
If the government is seriously inclined to curb this security, they should, as a matter of urgency, declare a state of emergency on security and deploy enough resources. Not a lipstick deployment. Deploy security to all these nook and crannies, especially the rural areas, to protect the vulnerable people.
Sani also suggested that police should develop a better intelligence gathering mechanism to help preempt crime. Reacting to the crime data, Daniel Boala, special advisor to the president on public communication, said the report was aimed at ensuring data transparency. He said in a statement that the report seeks to ensure that information released to the public is data-driven. The National Bureau of Statistics has confirmed that its website was hacked after releasing the data on insecurity in the country. It said engineers were working to restore the site. This is Mike Mbonye for VOA News in Lagos.
In the Democratic Republic of the Congo, many of the farmers tending to their fields in the troubled eastern region are guarded by United Nations peacekeepers. The UN Security Council voted on Friday to extend the mandate for the long-running UN peacekeeping mission known as MINUSCO for another year, delaying the previously agreed-to withdrawal from the conflict-torn eastern provinces. MINUSCO Northern Sector's Commander Brigadier General Manzuro Alam tells Reuters that Operation Secure Harvest, as it's known, began about 2 years ago.
We have seen that during the harvesting season, that means the October, November and December, the population goes to the field for harvesting their agricultural goods. And the perpetrators, that means the armed group, they take this opportunity and then incur in those agricultural field to loot the assorted items from them, to the loot the agricultural products from them, and there had been a lot of killings also in the agricultural field.
That's MINUSCO Northern Sector's Commander Brigadier General Manzuro Alam. The UN mission has fallen under increasing scrutiny over the years as the eastern conflict between rebel groups, self-defense forces, and other militias has raged. But in Djougou territory, farmers are unequivocal in their support for MINUSCO. Many of the farmers have been displaced from their homes by the conflict and shelter in camps near the UN bases. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and today is Monday, December 23rd. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Still to come on our program, Samson Omali's Sports Report. Mozambique's death toll from Cyclone Chido has now risen to 94, according to the French news agency AFP. It said on Sunday that it was citing the country's disaster management agency. The cyclone had made landfall in northern Mozambique a week ago. Mozambique's Institute for Natural Disaster late last week had given the death toll at 73. The French territory of Mayotte in the Indian Ocean off the coast of Mozambique bore the brunt of the storm. 35 fatalities there have been confirmed, but officials have said they fear that thousands could have been killed by Chido. Generative artificial intelligence companies are racing to build on the popularity of programs like ChatGPT, but AI regulation has not kept pace with the technology. Now, an incoming administration could favor U.S. domination over risk mitigation. Tina Trin reports.
A major announcement from President-elect Donald Trump and SoftBank CEO Masayoshi Son.
I'm thrilled to announce that SoftBank will be investing $100 billion in America, creating 100,000 American jobs at a minimum. It will help ensure that artificial intelligence, emerging technologies, and other industries of tomorrow are built, created, and grown right here in the USA.
Innovations in generative artificial intelligence are advancing at a rapid pace, fueled in part by the popularity of large language model programs like ChatGPT, which are trained on vast quantities of textual data to generate new content. But the technology's seemingly unlimited capabilities raise questions about safety and regulation. Kevin Werbach is a professor of legal studies and business ethics at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania.
The Trump administration has been very clear that it wants to eliminate a lot of the AI regulation that was put into place in the Biden administration, saying they want to unshackle AI to win the AI war against China to lead the world.
At the recent AI summit in New York, attendees expressed excitement for the future of AI, but also a desire for policies and standards that will help mitigate its harms. Here's Werbach again.
Companies want to understand how to avoid the kinds of footfalls and PR disasters that happen when, for example, AI is biased or AI fails to operate as designed.
Gaming entrepreneur Jay Watts notes the calls for transparency from both creators and companies like Valve, a major video game developer and distributor.
Now it is forcing the companies to say how they're using AI instead of just using all these generative assets that you're getting from somewhere, potentially infringing on someone else's rights.
Ensuring that generative AI models are trained on quality data is ideal, but developers don't always have access to it. Dr. Ocean Anand leads the data science practice at Sahej AI.
When you use a pre-trained version of a large language model, even if you fine-tune the last layer, you do not have control on the massive amount of data it is already trained on. So there could be tuning, but there's no concept of unlearning that data.
Experts suggest incorporating measurements and benchmarks to assess an AI program's performance, which they hope will ultimately drive more business. Again, Dr. Anand.
That's how you get buy-in, that's how you build in confidence.
Others contend that a regulatory approach that's too heavy-handed could stifle innovation and competition. Jiajun Liu is the founder and CEO of Acool, an AI video and audio generation company.
If some countries are more aggressive on regulations and some countries are less, then probably the tech companies will move across different countries. AI is the field that every country wants to win, so they will align their regulations.
As artificial intelligence advances, human intelligence must still determine the right balance between innovation and order. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, Carol. We begin the sport with the CAF Champions League. Title holders Al Ahly of Egypt sent a powerful statement of intent in the CAF Champions League as Wassem Abu Ali's hat-trick inspired a 6-1 thumping win over CR Belouizdad on Sunday. This marks the biggest victory of the group stage so far, reaffirming Al Ahly's determination to retain their title. The victory propels Al Ahly to the top of Group C with 7 points, 2 ahead of Orlando Pirates of South Africa, who drew with Stade d'Abidjan in the group's other match day 3 fixture last week. In women's football, host Ghana lifted inaugural Wafo B under 17 Girls Cup on Sunday, but only after a 5-4 penalty shootout defeat of a resilient Nigerian side at the Ghanaian Center of Excellence in Prampam outside Accra. Both sides earlier scored 2 goals apiece in regulation time but needed a penalty shootout to determine the winner of the tournament. In athletics, several top Kenyan athletes are ready to compete in the inaugural Magical Kenya Mountain and Trail Running Series launched by the Athletics Kenya and the Kenyan Tourism Board. The 6-legged series is expected to start with the Tinderet Bagatuni Mountain Run on January 18th, 2025. The Bagnetuni edition will also be used by the Athletics Kenya to select the Kenya mountain running team to the World Championships slated for Spain next year. John Olutua is Kenya's Principal Secretary for Tourism.
It's an opportunity to the youth to be able to exploit their talents. And I want to really indicate that Athletics Kenya and the Bagatuni mountain run has been doing a good job that most of our athletes have been able to run, not just here in Kenya, but internationally.
A British Ugandan athlete has arrived in London after running all the way from South Africa to raise awareness about racism. It took Diokato 518 days to cover the 8,230 miles from Cape Town. Diokato's journey took him through war zones. Along the way, he said he endured serious illness, several weeks in jail, and after reaching Europe, daily racist abuse.
I did become unwell. I had a few stomach issues. I had a few muscle pains because I was sleeping on the concrete floor. So I had a lot of muscle pain, fatigue, a few issues. So my fitness completely went low to where I was before.
And finally, in netball news, Netball Namibia President Rebecca Goagosus has addressed mixed reactions that trailed the inclusion of a male netball team in the recently concluded Netball Africa Cup. The Netball Namibia President called for an end to the stereotypes and emphasized that netball is a sport for everyone, regardless of gender. And that's it for this Monday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, Carol, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good rest of your holiday week. And that is it for this Monday, December 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And we're also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows like Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the entire Daybreak Africa crew, I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, wishing you a great week. We'll see you again on Tuesday morning.